Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Messages for Humanity podcast. And today we are with Matthew Remsky from Toronto, who is also a yoga teacher, an author. There's a fantastic book he's got out at the moment about cult dynamics in the yoga community, which is exactly why I asked him if he would come on this call a few days ago. Already the Yogi Bhajan and 3HO story was breaking, but only yesterday did B's article add to already these clamoring voices. So this conversation is timely, it's raw, it's up for all of us. And so I just want to ask Matthew, first of all, do you feel that we are seeing that the core of yoga has in fact been corrupted, or not what we imagined it to be? Or is our consciousness changing and we don't need those radical techniques anymore, those catalyzing moments, those initiations that are often humiliating, brutal? Over to you, Matthew.
It's a huge question. I mean, the first part of it, are we seeing yoga as being revealed as corrupt, or I think that's how you generally phrased it, really begs the question of how we define our terms. I think that the tidal wave, the continuing and now decades-long tidal wave of institutional abuse crises in modern yoga movements are really about modern yoga movements. And my research doesn't go back much beyond the 1930s in South India. So usually what we're talking about when we are looking at the stories of 3HO or Ashtanga yoga or Manuso Manos in relation to Iyengar yoga or Bikram Chowdhury is we're talking about people who emerged into a kind of charismatic prominence during the era of globalization. And they carried with them some antiquated ideas, or at least they manipulated some antiquated ideas. But some real ideas, but repurposed for their own devices. Ideas around spiritual authority and initiation and things like Shaktipat in Joyce's case. Mm-hmm. So there's been a real confusion around the actual status of these men with regard to their connections, their integrity, their linkage to the past. For the most part, the claims that people like Harbhajan Singh, Patabi Joyce, and Mr. Iyengar and Mr. Manos and Mr. Chowdhury make upon authenticities of the past are really, really tenuous or outright deceptive. And so, it's not, I don't think yoga as a whole is being revealed as something other than what it was, but certainly modern yoga movements have betrayed their promise and have displayed a remarkably bad and consistently bad track record in caring for the communities that they foster and benefit from. So, I think the second part of your question was, are we seeing an abandonment or a new skepticism towards the epiphany experience within the modern yoga? I would also say the modern Buddhist movements. And that's a super interesting question, because almost everybody is recruited into these movements through some epiphanic revelatory experience that is then either mobilized or emphasized or becomes part of the love bombing of the community. And I think people are starting, even a term like love bombing is becoming a little bit more well known. And I think that people are in general starting to pick up on what the cult literature has been talking about for the last 40 years. Which is that, if you are situationally or socially vulnerable, and you enter a group experience that promises you the world and seems to give you glimpses of heaven, you may not be in a safe place.
Mm.
And as that becomes more and more common knowledge, I think that can only be a healthy thing, not only for people generally, but also for yoga communities as perhaps they come down more to earth. Mm. I mean, the conversion experience is huge, and it's often like a key entryway into an indoctrination process when the group that confers it or that facilitates it is actually toxic.
Yes. I remember when I was a student, I'd read my autobiography of a yogi, a couple of other books, and I really made an understanding inside of me that this process was going to be hard,
mm-hmm.
that the refinement of the ego would involve, you know, a real shaving off, a real smoothing, a refinement. And
right.
These old books, they suggested that humiliation, you know, even brutality, definitely initiations of endurance and stamina, that all of these things was what I was needing to expect.
Right.
So I remember being in that situation and saying to myself, this is what's to be expected. This is
right.
What's needed. I have to go through this. I have to refine my ego. So, you know, there was a part of me that was definitely playing ball.
Right.
Years later, I do not want nor need or shall be part of that treatment ever again.
Maybe right.
That's what I mean by our consciousness is changing, because all of us, we were under that impression. And we were laughing at the levels of inner pain that we were going through, because it was a challenge and we've got to get through this, because this
right.
is how the ego softens.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a big issue, and a couple of things that come to mind just on a visceral level for me is that in the modern yoga landscape, the bodily and psychological sacrifices that can contribute to this kind of economy of, well, I have to pay X in order to get Y, are often, they're quite visceral. You know, in Ashtanga yoga, pain is elevated into this transformative act.
Yes.
In certain meditation practices, the intensity of the length with which you're sitting, or the ferociousness of the breath work that you're doing, are you know, can stimulate really activated responses, perhaps even traumatizing responses. And the extremes are always interpreted in terms of the bounded choice of, this has to be good. This has to be good for you.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be surprised that, you know, reconstructing your identity is a scary thing.
Yeah.
What would you expect? So in the communities that I was recruited into, that was a very common theme, which yeah. was, fear is good. You move towards it. It's a sign that you are overcoming some kind of limitation or some kind of false self.
Yeah.
I was never given any indication that, well, actually, fear actually makes a lot of sense intuitively. You've been a human being for a long time on this planet, and you know what a threat actually is.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that your comment brings up, your reflection brings up, is that, you know, there's a way in which there might, I don't have the sociology on this, but there's a way in which my prior indoctrination as a Catholic, I think, was influential in perhaps accentuating the sacrificial aspect of
yeah.
a spiritual practice. I mean, I, you know, I spent my childhood kneeling before the, you know, images of martyred saints or even the beloved son mm-hmm. of God who is murdered and listening and then starting really to see into those paradoxes and to see them for what they were. My pathway to that really was starting to listen to Leonard Cohen songs at the age of 14. Mm. You know, I'm specifically remembering the Song of Isaac, where he sings from the perspective of the boy following Abraham up the mountain in order to be sacrificed. Mm. And the way that this is sort of elucidated in the song is this, it's like, it's this moment of strange, terrifying bonding over the child's impending death. And when he's not sacrificed in the end, then that's a wonderful, glorious thing. But the basic premise that, you know, God would tell a father to kill his son is never really examined. Mm-hmm. And so it's, I feel like I personally emerged from a kind of cultural psychopathology around the meaning of care versus terror. Mm. And I think that cultic organizations are really expert at playing that up and mobilizing that against people who may have that in their backgrounds.
Absolutely. I have been reading a lot of the comments of the young students coming to terms with the latest revelation in Kundalini yoga. And my heart absolutely goes out for them because mm-hmm. they don't know what to do. Do they burn their books? Do they get rid of their
right.
names that maybe Yogi Bhajan gave them? Should they ask for a refund? Everything, the whole world has just shattered and crumbled.
Right.
What could we say? Because I'm a little bit old in the tooth. I left right. that community a long while ago, but I still personally practice in right. my way. Mm-hmm. I don't recite the mantras. I don't refer to Yogi Bhajan, but the physical practice is still there.
Right.
As more of a physical modality, my own music, my right. own sacred space. What do you do when your teacher and the community has been exposed like this?
Well, just to remark on some of the comments and disclosures that I think I've seen as well, I think it's extraordinary to watch an entire generation go through a kind of purgation. Mm-hmm. Even though there's something about it that is almost desperate or perhaps impotent in a way there was one photograph and disclosure from a youngish man in I think in British Columbia here in Canada, who had shorn off his beard that he had grown out since becoming part of Sikh Dharma, yeah. as it's known in 3HO, and I found that to be a very stunning image, that there's this sort of external sign of identification with a group that he was just going to get rid of. But it was interesting because he was like, in the last frame of the photo series, he was holding his shorn beard and he was wearing the turban at the same time.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that, so, all right, step by step. not quite sure how much else has to go. It was interesting to see the ripping up of the certificates from mm-hmm. students in Spain, you know, as in like, here, my Kundalini training is no good for anything anymore. But that's different from the beard it feels a little bit different from the beard because that's more about, well, what is this professional identification actually good for now? Like, mm-hmm. So that's another sort of aspect to it. People burning their books is pretty interesting as well, as though the books themselves are part of the illusion that somehow practice is going to remove. I mean, there's that feeling in there. There's also just the feeling of I'm done and I want to go out with a bang.
Yeah.
But I think. To me, I think we have to answer the question from a perspective of like, who's going through the purgation and why. Mm-hmm. For rank and file students, you know, in some ways there's less at stake. You know, if your profession and your social identity is not bound up and your finances are not bound up in trying to make money from what is now an incredibly damaged brand, then you're really talking about walking away from a community and a way of life. If you are professionalized into 3HO or KRI or any of the arms of the organization, that becomes a lot more complicated. Yeah. And this is where in my book, I suggest that about Joyce, I suggest that, you know, for all of the yoga teachers and professionals and service providers out there who carry degrees or certifications from compromised communities, it's really on them now to show how they are going to mitigate the compromise of that education. Like if you've been an Iyengar teacher and you have been waving around your certificate from iNouse for 20 years, but then, you know, somebody looks at it and they realize that it was signed by Manuso Manos, you'd better show your students that you've taken trauma sensitivity training, that you've become a mandated reporter for sexual abuse for your jurisdiction, that you, like, you've got to show what you've done to respond transparently to the fact that, wow, you've been in a compromised sociology. To whatever extent you were aware of it, that's what you're connected to. And you've got to take responsibility for the fact that you intend to continue to make money or to exist within that professionalism. So I'd say that for Kundalini yoga teachers, they have a really kind of clear opportunity at this point to not, the problem with ripping up the certificate is that you really can't erase the past. You can't say to your future students, well, that didn't really happen. Yeah. Or I didn't really initiate my yoga experience that way. No, you did. And it was problematic in the same way that, you know, I went to an all boys militarized Catholic school as a child, and that was problematic, but I'm not going to say that that didn't happen. I'm going to say that it did happen. This is how it wounded me. This is how I've tried to recover from it. And this is how I hold myself accountable. You know, one of the things that we really shouldn't do, I think, in this position, if we're professionalized, is to try to clear the slate. I think the most obvious example of this is seen when you Google EddieStern.com. He would be he has been the foremost representative of the Joyce family and Ashtanga yoga, certainly in the US and arguably throughout the world for the last several decades. And after my book was published and a number of other pieces of literature came out, he erased all reference to Patabi Joyce from his bio and closed down his yoga shala. Now there's probably financial stuff involved with that, but like he's rebranded himself as kind of an independent teacher who is an expert in yoga, but the bio is very generic. And the truth is that he would not have the social status that he had unless he had ridden on the coattails of the Joyce family for as long as he did. And not just ridden on the coattails, like served them, really served them like that. And earnestly was devoted to them. So I don't want to be cynical about his relationship to them. Like he really did love them, but you can't like just say that didn't happen, because you are where you are because it did happen. And your students have to be clear about that, or else how are they going to be assured that you're providing a safe space?
Another aspect I'd like to raise is, again, when I was a young Kundalini student, we'd see the older teachers come in and they'd kind of glide in. They'd glide in with their entourage, and you know, in the Kundalini community, jewels and external symbology of wealth and empire building. And we would look on and kind of, you know, we're from Europe. So we're like, what the heck is this?
Right.
My deep intuition says that those teachers should be taken care of, that that does not build up around them. Because if there isn't already something within us, like a narcissism or a pathology, if it's not there, then that level of status is a perfect breeding ground to start that process off.
So yeah, I think I would tend to agree with that. I'm amused by your European comment, because yeah, I mean, you got rid of your monarchs 200 years ago or 300 years ago, and here they glide in, but sort of pseudo Indian. I mean, there are many ways that the power of the leader is controlled through what I think the sociologists call routinization, right? Mm-hmm. So Yogi Bhajan's own taste for furs and jewels and you know, cars and so on ends up becoming a kind of networked symbology of power. Yeah. And even with regard to this kind of pseudo government that he sets up, through all of these very sort of bureaucratic organizations, that's a very, I think, understudied or under remarked upon. I mean, the book has only been out for a month, so, you know, I'm not criticizing anybody for not pointing this out, but like, you know, Premka's book, Pamela Dyson's book, has a lot of data in it about the kind of shadow government or shadow UN that Bhajan sets up. And it's, what's interesting is that the same thing happened in the Shambhala world, which I also study. I've got a feature coming out on the intergenerational violence and trauma in Shambhala between Chogyam Trungpa and his son. That's in April or something like that. And he too created this kind of you know, fantastical government and kingdom, where he was the ultimate ruler, where there was no external authority. Like, he printed his own passports, where the names were written out in Tibetan and English calligraphy. They had a national anthem. They had their own currency. I don't get the sense that Bhajan went that deeply into literalism, but the same kind of, you know, worldly power structure was certainly a way of routinizing and networking his power. Mm. Now, you know, would there be his senior students who would somehow be more corruptible by that? Perhaps, I suppose. But I mean, the corruption happens far before that. It happens with, and I'm sure you know this, that it happens with the fact that all of those senior students are with various levels of self-awareness, they're enabling or bystanding abuse. Mm. And when they start getting the jewels, they're also benefiting from the silencing of the abuse, which is something that my friend and colleague Karen Rain points out all the time, is that, you know, the people who end up becoming successful in a community that is rife with institutional abuse have literally, it's not just that they've climbed the ladder well, it's that they have benefited from the silencing of the institution's victims. And that's a crappy thing to put a crown on, let me tell you. I mean, like, it must feel awful. And so I also have a kind of almost absurd empathy for the person who, you know, drifts into a room as though they're special when, you know, they're trailing this shadow behind them.
Something that's coming. I've been in this situation twice.
Right.
Kundalini yoga. But right. In Europe, we didn't get to see that inner circle of 3HO too often. Right. Maybe once a year with our, you know, the white tantra. They'd come over from the States and then we'd see that inner circle and how how that was. But then I've kind of sailed through a very similar kind of setup where I myself was actually a little bit close to the center of this. It never took off. This community never took off, but by golly, it was heading in that direction.
Right.
And instead of being on the sidelines, I was actually in the center of it all.
Yeah.
So I've been in this murky water twice. I have a question that if there is, let's just say there's a teaching. Mm-hmm. And you have been given this teaching by a corrupted teacher, master, guide. And you might have a sentimental compassion, and this is my language, that says, I can clean this teaching up. I can do the work around this teaching. I can pray, I can dance, I can do all of my thing to clean it up and re-represent it to the world, cleaned, without a blemish, without a smudge.
Right.
Do you feel that is possible?
I think you will have changed it.
Mm.
I think you will have, at that point, you will have created something anew. And if that creation process has come with an awareness of, oh, you know, spiritual content is not purposed for abusing people, then that's probably good. I think the question depends upon ideas around lineage and authenticity and truths that are primal or that, and also that are precious and hard to come by, hard to find, that must be recovered and preserved. So every one of the charismatic leaders that I've studied orients themselves towards their content as though they have preserved some kind of ancient universal wisdom.
Yes.
And I think it's a very effective tactic for hiding one's abusive behavior, because the value, the purported value of this ancient thing can always be put in front of the person as though they're the postman, as they would say in 3HO, or they're the messenger, or they are just doing the will of their own guru, or they are a mouthpiece, or they are some sort of empty vessel. You know, even the tulku structure of transmission within Tibetan Buddhism allowed for some similar things to be said about Trungpa Rinpoche, where, you know, what he was actually doing as a material human being in relation to actual other material human beings was actually smaller than, you know, the grander mythological narrative of what the incarnations of the Trungpas were doing, or what the Rigdons were doing, or what, you know, how the Dharma was progressing, or how the next Terma was going to be unveiled. Mm. And so, you know, without saying anything really definitive about the reality of ancient, you know, special teachings or whatever, I'm just not qualified to talk about that. I have no idea what is ancient, what is ancient and what isn't. What I know is that everything that I encounter is mediated through somebody right now, right? And so I can't really say, oh, this thing is separated from the way in which I received it. I mean, I'm Canadian, and we have an intellectual here who influenced everybody really, really hardcore, Marshall McLuhan, and his mantra was the medium is the message. And that's, you know, that's like in my bones. If there's a dharmic, you know, sentiment that I have, it's Marshall McLuhan, the medium is the message. The way in which something is communicated is the thing. Mm. And so, you know, it's like all of these people trying to bend over backwards, trying to say, well, you know, let's take, you know, Kundalini yoga by Yogi Bhajan, let's take Yogi Bhajan out of that sort of branding. That's a real struggle. I think you can do that, but what you end up doing is you end up creating something new, and that should be celebrated.
Yes.
Now, if it's conscious, if it is transparent, the person will also say, I'm making something new out of this because the way in which this dude did it was abusive, and that's not what I want. That's not what I'm here for.
Yeah.
I mean, yoga and Buddhist scholarship, like top-notch critical editions, translations of the Pali Canon or of medieval Buddhism from the Sanskrit, or, you know, really good translations of the Yoga Sutras or of the Hatha Yoga literature in medieval times, they give you some pretty accurate insights into how people thought and felt and practiced in those time periods. But we are generally not in modern yoga and Buddhist cultures taught by academics how to practice. We're taught by people who are charismatically inclined to lead movements. And that's a different thing. They more often than not, they actually have an incentive to suppress academic knowledge, or to ignore it, or to generalize it, or to make it their own in some ways. So yeah, that's a very long-winded question, answer to this question of like, can you separate the baby from the bathwater? And I would say, once you do, you've got a new baby, and that's cool. That should be celebrated, and it should be a conscious act. You know, if Yogi Bhajan could make up Sikh Dharma, basically whole cloth, then why can't you make up something just as creative without the purpose of having it cover over, you know, institutional abuse? Is he that much smarter than you? I mean, does he tuned in more than you are? Like it's that's what I would say to the young person, actually. Is like, you know, don't buy look at what charisma, which is a social phenomenon, is convincing you about this person.
Talking of which, I'd like to wrap it up soonish, but not yet. I've still got more questions.
Right.
Narcissism. Mm-hmm. Psychopath. Exposure to internet. Are they connected?
That's beyond my scope. I mean, I have sort of a pop culture understanding of narcissism and psychopathology, but I'm not a psychotherapist. And usually when I'm involved in, you know, anti-cult journalism or I'm doing research in cultic studies, the encouragement from the discourse is to focus more on sociological mechanisms and patterns rather than psychological profiles. Because Yogi Bhajan never went to therapy. So we have no bloody clue what was going on inside, right? We can only really guess.
Yeah.
What's it called? It's called the Goldwater Rule in the States, I think, where Barry Goldwater was showing some psychopathologies, and psychiatrists started to make comments in the newspapers about, you know, how he might be ill. And I think the APA came out and said, actually, that's unethical. You can't diagnose somebody from your armchair by reading a newspaper. Don't do it. There's a similar kind of attitude in cultic studies, let's not try to guess what Yogi Bhajan is going on about, or what's going on internally for Mr. Chowdhury. But your question about like linking, you know, psychopathologies to internet usage is like super interesting to me, not because I know much about psychopathology, but because it is really, really clear that what's happening over the last couple of years with the activation of the Me Too movement through digital technology is that we're seeing not new stories come out, because everybody knew about Yogi Bhajan in the 1980s, and there was a whole exodus away from his group then.
Yes.
It's more like people can instantly connect with and share and merge and vicariously live through each other their ongoing immediate experiences of disillusionment. And that's like, and they can be exposed to toxic behaviors that they find very triggering. And so there's a lot going on in a group like the Premco group. It's fascinating, almost terrifying to watch. And it moves so fast, which is also gives me this sense of like embodied psychology. Like there's stuff going on before anybody knows what it actually means. I don't really think I answered that, but I think it's super interesting to look at the effect of instantaneous merging communication with regard to whether or not communities can rebond, really, because that would be the good outcome.
Yes.
One of the things that's happening in the online Shivananda community through a page called Satya is that dissidents but people who also sort of lay claim to the moral center of the organization have gathered a number of anti-high demand group resources. They've been, supporting survivors' voices and listening to stories as they come out. But then they've also been organizing so that they can crowdsource and crowdfund their own independent investigation of the organization, which is like amazing. It's an amazing idea. It would be kind of like, I'm going to be putting this in an upcoming article, but it's kind of like, rank and file parishioners in a Boston Catholic church realizing that their priest has been abusing children for many years and that the bishop has protected them. And so they go and they don't protect the police. They don't trust the police because they know the police are in on it. They're Catholic too. And so they hire their own independent gumshoes to do an investigation that they then are proposing to publish just on the internet. Which will create tremendous pressure upon the organization. So it's like, depending upon what they report, there's a lot happening in this particular age. And going back to your first comment, yeah, I think a lot of people are learning a lot, and they're learning a lot very fast.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to thank you so much, Matthew, for what you do and your articles and your books that you're publishing, and this absolutely crystal clear. And to me, it feels absolutely straight down the middle, a very clear voice and very clear speaker on this subject. Back in my day, I didn't know anybody. I mean, there was a few conspiracy theorists running around talking about cult dynamics. But it's so wonderful to know that there's you around, there's B also around, keeping an eye on things and raising the alarm when truth needs to be told.
Well, thank you very much. That means a lot.
Yay. Thank you so much, Matthew.
It's great to talk to you.
You too.